we're going to talk about finish up tissue repair and go on to immunopathology. How many people have taken any immunology course in undergraduate? All right. We'll bring the rest of you to their level and beyond. Okay. So secondary union, remember we saw that gentleman with the large wound. Couldn't close the edges of wound. When that occurs, that means you have a lot of granulation tissue there, which is what color, grossly, when you look at it clinically? Red. Paint the red because angiogenesis, VEGF being released by the macrophages, who are the orchestrators of tissue repair. So you have the myofibroblasts around the edge of the wound, and you have cross-linking of the collagen type 1 as it's being remodeled from type 3 to 1. That's going to cause the wound contraction. The wound contraction and scarring is going to be more prominent, but it's going to be smaller than the original wound. We know that clinically. So when you look at the wound initially, everybody's worried you're going to have a big scar. Well, if you let it go to its completion in optimal situation, then it'll become a smaller size wound compared to the original wound. And obviously, if we can't close it, we have broken down a barrier. And so now what could grow in there? Bacteria. So when you have an infected wound, you're going to close it by secondary intention. Because if you close a wound that's full of bacteria, it will now cause anaerobic situation and the bacteria can grow. And then PMNs come in, they release collagenase and the wound rips open. We call this wound dehiscence. Is the term, wound dehiscence. So obviously it takes a lot longer to crawl as a squamous cell from the stem cells. They're going to give rise to the new epithelial barrier, like we're talking about the skin. So it's going to be a lot longer. The advantages, obviously, you can close a large defect this way. That's how they do it clinically. You'll see this. Versus bringing the edges of the wound together and approximating it to minimize scarring. And obviously, you're going to close wounds that are contaminated. Otherwise, you set up the problem of secondary infection within the wound and wound dehiscence. And you'll see this in various clinical situations, especially if people have, for example, an open compound fracture. They've fractured the bone, it's punctured the skin. And that wound, if it's infected, will be closed by secondary intention. But if it's clean, they know it's clean, then it'll be primary intention, depending upon the size of the wound. The larger the defect, the larger the likelihood you've got to close by secondary intention. And this becomes very important. So what are the complications? Like any type of situation, you always have to be concerned what could happen that can minimize the beneficial outcome to the patient. Well, we just talked about wound dehiscence that can be secondary infected. That's why it's critical that when you have a wound that you clean it right away. Because you want to minimize the bacterial contaminant. That's why we talked about if you had a contaminated wound with a lot of bacteria, what would you put in there to expedite it is hydrogen peroxide. But not a whole lot. Because you don't want to cause further injury to the tissue because it's an irritant. Remember, hydrogen peroxide is converted by myeloperoxidase with chloride to make what? Bleach. So you don't want to be pouring bleach in your wound. You could, but it's going to cause irritation and more tissue injury. I guess if you were in a pinch and you didn't have hydrogen peroxide, you could make a very dilute solution of bleach. Not the full strength. You could get away with it, but not a whole lot. Just to quickly clean it. Because it's an antioxidant. It's basically an oxidant that's going to damage the bacteria or whatever else is in the wound. Wound contraction, obviously, this is very important to you as physical therapists, especially when you're remodeling the collagen and how it's going to be used and having the patient following through. I've seen patients like my next door neighbor who got a knee replacement and she didn't follow the physical therapy and she got decreased range of motion, and then they go in there and guess what? Lyse the contractions because you didn't follow the OT, the physical therapy and OT. So you want to get your patients because otherwise you're going to be back again. You got to tell them the importance of it. Then once you get the wound contraction, then the range of motion of the joint, for example, is a problem. So we got issues. Because we're genetically unique, some people make a lot of granulation tissue. We call this proud flesh, and that's going to take longer for the remodeling. And then you have people that have problems with the remodeling phase. And these are, you can see in a lot of patients, or a number of patients, I should say, where there's a problem of going from collagen type 3 to collagen type 1. The two classic examples you see clinically, which you'll see, because you can see the skin, is a hypertrophic scar, means a big scar, right? Hypertrophic just means big in size, but it's to the confines of the wound versus a keloid. A keloid will go beyond the confines of the wound in which this remodeling phase cannot be completed to type 1. Yes?
What do you mean by proud flesh?
Proud flesh means that you have a lot of granulation tissue. It's bulging out. It's like foaming out of the wound. You have some people have very exuberant tissue repair process. That's all it means. So you have more granulation tissue than you would normally expect. So it's sort of bulging out. And obviously, there's going to prolong tissue repair because remember, you got to remodel it and get those squamous cells to recomplete the barrier. So it can lead to longer wound healing. We're all genetically different. If I were to inflict a wound in each one of you, you would heal at different paces and outcomes. Even if we controlled it precisely, we're all genetically different. And this becomes important. You just can't say this person has this disease you've seen 100 times, and another person, it can respond in a different way that you did not expect. You talk to any of your physical therapy professors or anybody else, and you ask them, if you look at 100 patients of this disease you treated, have they all been the same? What do you think their answer will always be? Never. So guess what? It's like going to Baskin Robbins. You know you're going to get ice cream, but you're going to get all these flavors that come with it. So what you're learning here is the prototypes. What the people do outside this door, anything goes. And that's what you always have to remember. On exams, whether it's national or local, whether it's at San Francisco State or here at UCSF, you have to realize we're giving you the ideal situations. In the real world, something else happens. That's why you've got to keep it simple. Okay? For example, here's a young lad. And he's very proud, and you can see he's smiling, and he's proud about his scar. He survived his operation. So you can see it's a big scar, isn't it? But it's still within the confines of the wound, so we call this a hypertrophic scar. Okay? So that's how it's bulging out. And this is his genetic makeup in terms of how he's responding to the remodeling phase. How many people have pierced their ears? All right, is that a big wound or a little wound? Little chiquito, right? Well, in some people, a wound like that may give you something like this. And we would call that a keloid because it's gone beyond the confines of the wound. And this is an example. So when people are body piercing, you don't know what your body's going to do until you do it. So keloids tend to occur in darkly pigmented individuals. Not always, but they can. They tend to. And they tend to occur above the waist. You're not going to see this in the feet or the lower extremities. Why? No one really knows. But this is a classic example. It may be because of blood supply, maybe for a variety of reasons, but no one really knows. But if you take a look at it histologically, you'll notice you see these refractile bundles of collagen. See this collagen right here? So do you think a keloid is stronger than a typical scar or weaker? A lot weaker because it's made of what? Collagen type 3. Remember, this is a remodeling problem where you cannot convert it to 3, so the 3 accumulates and accumulates where you can't break it down and remodel it to 1. So 3, it has plasticity, it has less tensile strength than collagen type 1, and we know that scarring, like fibrosis like this, is weaker to begin with, so it's got to be definitely weaker. So if you have a patient who has a keloid, then obviously in the wound, they're more likely to have rupture of the wound in the healing phase rather than somebody has typical collagen type 1. Okay? Here's a story from CNN. Even CNN shows things. This is a young woman who's 32 years old, decides to get married. She got a tattoo in her former younger life, and she wanted to remove it because she wanted a wedding dress, and she didn't want anybody to know she had a tattoo. So what does she do? Because, you know, weddings, are they cheap or expensive, typically? Expensive. So once she goes to a salon to have them remove it, because she wanted to save money. Well, she didn't save money. And they put too many jewels in the laser that's used to remove tattoos, because the laser is doing what? It's breaking down the chemical bonds, the double bonds that reabsorbs light to give its color. So when you get a laser therapy for a tattoo, all you're doing is clinically are chemically changing the molecular structure of the pigment, but you don't get rid of it. You just can't see it. But it's there in the macrophage. So they put too much energy into it, and what did she get? She got a hypertrophic scar and half a tattoo left. Now she's really upset, and the wedding's getting closer. Then she decides she better go to a dermatologist, and they remove both the hypertrophic scar and the keloid, and she lives happily ever after. So the moral of the story is there's iatrogenic forms of tissue repair or injury that you can get in these processes. And so today, people remove keloids and hypertrophic scars and tattoos with laser phototherapy, in this case, laser therapy. Because you're breaking down the molecules, but you don't want to cause what with the laser therapy is to cause further injury to the tissue, and now you're going to get a scarring response, as you can see here. So you have to use moderation. Otherwise, you get this. Okay? So it's a hypertrophic scar, because it's still within the confines of the wound. But if it went beyond that tattoo, you would call it what? See how you can just go on Muni and watch people, and you can make this diagnosis all the time. Keloid and hypertrophic scar, or on BART if you write it all day. You see them all the time. So what retards tissue repair? Because this becomes also important to you, because patients are going to have more than one condition. Obviously, the older you get, the more conditions you can accumulate, depending upon what your genetic makeup and what you've done during your life. It makes a big difference. So, this is not to memorize and not have a heart attack, but you have to do it in two broad strokes. You have to think of the wound site itself, and then you have to look at the whole body and how it's going to have an impact on that wound. So you have to think of it in two processes. The first is locally. What is one group of people that you'll be dealing with that are denervated are diabetics. They get sensory neuropathy, so they cannot feel pain. You would think that would be good. No, it's not so good, because pain is good. Because pain is an alarm system. And if you don't have an alarm system, you don't know you're being robbed. Or in this case, being injured. What's a classic organ in the body that people don't realize that they can be causing disease and not have pain is everyone's lungs. You'll have patients smoking marijuana, pot, cocaine. They'll say, oh, I feel great. No, you don't. Because if you were to look at your lungs, it's not pink anymore, but have been damaged because we don't have much nerve endings in our lungs. And that's a problem. Versus our skin, highly sensitive. You know you're feeling pain. So when you get sensory neuropathy of your skin and a diabetic, you don't know you stepped on a tack. You keep walking and you step on a tack, you'd be hitting that ceiling so high, you'd be jumping. And so this becomes a real problem. So when diabetics are important in terms of understanding when they have sensory neuropathy. Local infection, that's kind of obvious. You're going to bring more inflammatory cells. You start over, causes more tissue destruction. Foreign bodies, that's why you have to remove debris to wound. You want to get rid of dirt, gravel, dust, glass, whatever it is in there that they've been putting or they've introduced into the wound that can impede it. Because who's going to come in? Macrophages, what's the likelihood of producing scarring and further wound destruction? God bless you. Is that hematomas, localized collection of extravasated blood. Blood, it takes a lot of time to eat a red blood cell. It takes 4 hours for a macrophage just to eat a red blood cell. And then to break it down takes time. And so that's going to impede tissue repair. Mechanical stresses. Obviously, wounds are in a delicate situation structurally, and so they're prone to rupture. You got to worry about wound distance. So you have patients that want to, they've been exercised all their life, and they get a wound, they want to go out there, and you got to tell them, no, not quite yet. Otherwise, you're going to come back and visit, and we'll prolong the process. Necrotic tissue, that's why we debride the wound. Remember we talked to that patient who had the severe burn. You got to remove the dead tissue because it takes longer to break down dead tissue, and it's much quicker to reconstruct it. So we remove it as a consequence. Protective dressings. You want dressings to aerate because you can produce anaerobic situations where bacteria can get in there and then cause infection. And aggressive surgical techniques. How many people have seen people that are well known that have gotten a facelift and they look like they've got this type of face? Well, I can tell you what happened, because what is a facelift actually doing? They're tearing the dermis away from the subcutaneous fat, and they're really aggressive, and then it makes them look good at the time of the operation, but what happens to all wounds? wound contraction. Then it looks like this. And then you got to go back and redo it. So you got to give a little bit to the fibroblasts for wound contraction. That's why we got scleroderma. Too many fibroblasts in response to it. Age. Which age is the poorest wound healers? Older. Why? Because what happens to the number of stem cells as you get older? So your ability to regenerate decreases. So if you're going to get trauma, what age should you do it? Your age. Do it now. Get it out of your system and lead a tranquil life as best as you can. Because it'll take, there are other things that are going on. Anemia, decreased red blood cell mass, can't deliver oxygen. We know that tissue repair is highly oxygen dependent. It's very energy dependent to make ATP. Drugs, people are on steroids, cytotoxic drugs. They're on chemotherapy. They're going to destroy stem cells, interfere with tissue repair. That's a problem, isn't it? Genetic disorders involving collagen. For example, osteogenesis imperfecta. You have a problem of collagen type 1, they get brittle bone disease. Their bones fracture. They can have 200, 500 fractures in their lifetime as a consequence of collagen type 1. Marfans, Ehlers-Danlos. This all involves various structural molecules that are critical to the structural integrity of tissues, colon, the aorta, your skin, bones, tendons. Hormones, too much cortisol, like having steroids. Jaundice, unconjugated bilirubin or conjugated where jaundice is a toxin. Where it's a breakdown of red blood cells, the porphyrin ring, and it can be toxic to your tissue repair cells, including macrophages, and cause delay in tissue repair. Malignant disease, we're talking about cancers. They're taking away nutrients like folate, which is important for DNA synthesis, iron, things of this that are critical for tissue repair. Malnutrition, that's kind of obvious. You have people who are malnourished because they're the very young and they're very old, or they have eating disorders. You're not getting enough nutrition. They're going to be a problem because you don't have enough nutritional support. Obesity. It's estimated that about 33% of the adult population in the United States are now obese. When they get 10 to 15 centimeters of subcutaneous fat, it's hard to approximate those wounds and keep it. You can imagine the tensile strength. Minimize takes longer. Their open wound dehiscence increases. Infections, you're in septic shock or sepsis. You got all these cytokines being released that can interfere with the ability of tissue repair. Too hot, too cold. Trauma, hypoxia. They have lung disease like emphysema. They have to have oxygen supply because they can't have good gas exchange, so lung disease, or they have heart disease. If they have kidney disease, we call it uremia, where their renal function is not working and your electrolytes are accumulating, sodium, potassium. You've got waste products that are going to interfere and be toxic to macrophages and the fibroblasts and interfere with tissue repair. And vitamin C deficiency, cross-linking of collagen, that's a problem for wounds. And then trace metals, zinc and copper are cofactors in various metalloproteases that are important for remodeling, for example. Doesn't mean you have to go out and get zinc tablets all the time. No. Just if you eat a balanced diet, you can get all the metals you need. Otherwise, you're going to get hypervitaminosis or metal poisoning if you take too much of this. So the last thing, and before we go into immunopathology, is organization. This is a word that you'll see clinically used when you're in a disease process. When they're in the recovery phase, that's what the clinicians will call it in a disease process. But what's really going on is the body's doing what? Repairing it from the injury, from whatever it was, whether it's a traumatic injury, whether it's due to a heart attack, whether it's pneumonia. You can pick any disease you want. When they say in the recovery phase, they're going through what? Tissue repair in that organ, whether you see it in the skin or in that particular organ that's injured. So what are you going to see? You're going to see granulation tissue. So when you use the word, let's take Clinton, for example. She had pneumonia. So she's now in the organizing recovery phase. So she has organizing pneumonia. And she's feeling better because the lung is remodeling. And the cytokines, macrophages are going away. They're not required anymore. She's feeling better. So she has an organizing pneumonia. So when it involves body cavities, you do surgery, no matter what it is, heart surgery, lung surgery, in the peritoneal cavity, abdominal cavity. You're going to cause injury. You're going to irritate those surfaces of the lungs, and you can produce fibrous adhesions that can interfere with the lung function, cardiac function, bowel function. So you have to realize when patients say they had surgeries in the past, that could be a problem in terms of causing irritation. They have appendectomy. That's why people are doing what? Laparoscopic surgery rather than opening up, because if you do laparoscopic surgery, what's the likelihood of seeing fibrous adhesions? Decrease. That's why it's done. It's less invasive. They can in and out. Another important thing is valves. Heart valves are the thickness of what? One sheet of paper. Next time you turn a physical book and you think of that sheet of paper is the thickness of your heart valve. It's got to last you 90 years and then some. And so if you cause damage to that valve, which we'll see, or there are valvular diseases, then it becomes thickened like cardboard, it becomes less compliant, and it's going to interfere with blood flow through that valve to the next chamber. You think of your lung. It has a lot of compliance. It's less stiff, and therefore the elastic recoil isn't critical to lung function. Now, if you get interstitial fibrosis due to lung disease, whatever it may be, then it's going to cause wound contraction, decreased compliance, stiffness, and gas exchange is impeded. Now we have respiratory problems. So you can take any of these processes in any tissue, a ligament, a tendon, a joint, muscle, cardiac, skeletal, lung, GI tract. You can imagine its normal function. No matter the physiology you learn about, it will be impeded. Joint spaces. What's the clinical term for a fused joint? Because you're going to be working with these type of patients, a fused joint, no matter what the cause is. Ankylosis, ankylotic joint. When you hear the word ankylosis, it means fusion of the joint. It's been damaged, whatever the underlying cause, infection, trauma. And it means that you have fibrous union of the joint space. Rheumatoid arthritis, for example, is a classic autoimmune disease that can lead to an ankylosing process. If you call it ankylosing spondylitis, we think of fusion of the spine. Let's say autoimmune disease. Last but not least, an abscess, a localized collection of pus, can be walled off by a fibrous capsule. That's an organized abscess. Okay? So in summary, we talk about tissue repair. We have cellular vascular injury. Our response should too. We have acute inflammation we talked about, going on to regeneration, healing, and resolution. That's what we want for our patients. But if the persistent tissue injury occurs, they constantly irritate or damage that joint, what's the likelihood of scarring to go up? Always up. And it becomes a real problem. So you want to minimize the injury to that site by not causing persistent tissue injury. And then you're going to get more scarring, go on to chronic inflammation, and we got problems depending on what organ you're going to pick out there that causes problems, because you're going to have chronic inflammation, scarring, and fibrosis. So in summary, tissue repair is a very important biological process. As physical therapists, you're going to see this over and over again. You're going to see it on the outside. You'll see it mechanically on the outside or the behavior. And then you got to think of the organs you can't see, the tissue repair process, with its lungs, the heart, the intestines, the liver, whatever injury that's being assailed on that particular organ system is going through the same process. You just can't see it. You may see it from CT scans, MRI, x-rays, as indirect evidence that's going on. Each tissue, no matter what organ you pick in the body, has unique tools or array of complex biochemical and biological processes in response to the injury that occurs. And this is very important to always remember clinically. Since tissue repair has been known through humankind, it's been also used to identify what tribe you belong to, because they didn't have cell phones or tablets. They didn't have the internet. They didn't have television, radio. They didn't even have lights except the fireplace or fire outside. So they had to do something with their time. So what organ system would they manipulate? Yeah, because I had access to it all the time. And they saw wounding, and they realized, hey, I can make designs out of it. So it's been around since humankind. Any questions? No, guys are easy on a Monday. All right. Immunopathology. All right. Immunology. Have I showed you the slide before? Good. Deja vu. It must be an important slide if I keep repeating it. Because when you think of the immune system, what's the two main functions I mentioned that the immune system was designed for? What are the two main functions? This is always important clinically. You must always remember. Then you understand why you need an immune system. Infection, that's right. Microorganisms, bacteria, viruses, fungi, parasites. We live in a microbial ecosystem. So it's always important. What's the second very important function of the immune system? Very important to you as well. Get rid of dead cells in tissue. If we turn over 1 billion cells per hour, we slough them off, we swallow them, we scrape it off, or we have cells turning over and dying, we have to have macrophages, for example, coming in and eating them. So, or women in reproductive age, what happens every month? Menstrual cycle. Is it a painless or painful process? Why? Because why is it painful? Since what we've gone through, it should be able to explain to me now. What's happening in that endometrial wall? Well, why are they sloughing off those endometrial cells? They're going through death. They're dying because the blood vessels are clamping down. You get ischemia. And what's the first, if you were to look at the menstrual fluid under a microscope, what inflammatory cell would you see? A lot of. If it's dead tissue. You skipped a step. Neutrophils. So what you're going through is basically acute inflammatory process. That's what you're seeing. So that's a normal physiologic process, and you're getting acute inflammation in the uterine wall. Because why is it painful? Because you got dolor, you got tumor, you got rubor. If you could look in there, you would see that too. And obviously, dolor. It can be both. Because if it was apoptosis, do you typically see an inflammatory response? So you're... But what is that? But it's also, if you looked at the menstrual fluid, you would see a lot of neutrophils coming in response to it. Because you notice women vary depending upon how they complain about it. Some are debilitated. Some are, just a nuisance. I just know I have it, and that's fine. So why is that occurring? Because it's genetically what? Dependent upon your immune system and how you respond to it. Okay, so it's a spectrum. So less people, they probably have more apoptosis. People that are debilitated, definitely acute inflammatory response. Because what type of medicines do you take? NSAIDs. So you must have acute inflammatory process. It screams acute inflammation. Okay. So we talk about the immune system. Like the menstrual cycle, in terms of dead tissue or any type of infectious process, this is called the innate. In other words, remember, it's poised and ready to do battle. And what two cells that like to eat anything and everything? Neutrophils and macrophages. So macrophages are both of the innate. It's poised and ready to do battle with bacteria and dead cells. Within hours, not seconds or minutes, but hours. You have preformed molecules made by the hepatocytes. They have complement. They have clotting factors. This is all part of the process of acute inflammation. But the adaptive takes time, and we have two components. One is making humorals, another name for it, or making antibodies. The first antibody you make is IgM. Then it becomes IgG. So you have these various isotypes. There's IgD, there's IgE, IgA. Depending upon what's going on. It takes time to go through genetic rearrangement in the B cells that are found in your follicles, like in your lymph nodes or white pulpit or spleen, or in your bone marrow. It takes time to make those antibodies. That's why, what are people getting now? To make antibodies against what? You see in the second floor of Moffitt Cafeteria. Or the flu season. And what are they giving you? Antigens. To give you neutralizing antibodies and also activate your T cells. So if you do get the flu virus, it takes care of it. That's how the vaccine is working. Now, if there's a different strain of flu virus, well, we all missed it. And we get the flu if we get exposed to it. So that's why they got to make sure that the flu vaccine is going to match with the strain of virus is out there. Then you have T cells. T cells are important to go after virally infected cells. They go after, for example, parasites. They also go to slow-growing organisms like tuberculosis, for example. And so this takes time. T cells are critical. If patients who have transplants, for example, liver, lung, heart, now they're doing face, finger transplant, I mean, you do all sorts of things. And we got problems. And so they're looking at the self-antigens and on the surface of the cells that get transplanted, and they can respond and cause damage and also make antibodies to it and attack it, destroy it. And we call that transplant rejection. So when you hear the patients who have rejection, it means their immune system is rejecting that organ in response to antigens on those cells that are looked by the immune system and destroy it as it was formed. But what do you see on the x-axis that you always have to think about? Time. So the innate is what? In hours. Because what's the predominant white blood cell in your blood right now? Neutrophils. And they're geared to bacteria that can get in your bloodstream. They can get on your skin, in your organs. You're in a, somebody's coughing in the elevator, and you inhale particulate or aerosolized droplets with little bacteria ready to go down into your respiratory tract, or virus. What are you doing in an elevator? It's always interesting. When people start coughing, you notice the conversation stops, because what are people doing? They're holding their breath. Yeah, you can almost tell what people are doing just by their behavior. And they're not looking at their cell phone either. When's the next? I got to get out of here. I don't want to get this. So you can see there's a virus out there in close proximity. So here we see the humoral, which means antibody production, to some type of antigen. You're going to, it takes time to make the antibodies that are bound to the pathogen. And we know that we have receptors, Fc receptors, the part of the antibody that's on this. We have, this is the, what do you call the binding site to the antigen. This is like a fork. The prongs are where it's going to bind to the antigen. Well, the Fc portion is a constant region. There are two chains, heavy and light chains. And this will bind to receptors on the cell that's now bound to the microorganism. And who takes it up? A neutrophil or? Macrophage. And that's the fate. Now what happens to those pathogens? So the antibodies, when you have a flu vaccine, what is it going to do? It's going to bind to the virus. You're going to phagocytize it, take it out of the system. And then you'll get cytotoxic T cells that the virus is already inside the cell, tell it, we're going to cause you to die, to get rid of the virus that way too. So it's going to be both, it's an adaptive immune response. And here we see cellular response. Here we have a virus. Here you can see a T cell interacting because virus sheds antigens on its surface that interacts with other molecules that will now cause the infected cell to go through apoptosis. And you get the cell dies and taken up by macrophages, some phagocytic. So when you get a common cold, this is what's going on here too. Just close your eyes and play out the fate of that virus. Doesn't matter what the virus is, okay? Hepatitis, Zika, whatever it is. So now let's talk about the immune system in terms of disease. Anybody have any questions about the immune system? Whether it's your immunopath course, immunology course you had an undergraduate, or this is just sort of a big overview. You've got to remember, this is the big stuff. It gets, there are courses on this that would go into much far deeper detail, and we'd be feeling like we're going in quagmire. Okay, but you got to get the basics here. All right. We know that we have genes in the human genome, like any species of eukaryotic cells, that as an organism, we have genetically determined our immune system. That means that we can have genetic defects that you're born with that we call primary immune deficiency. So when you hear a patient has a primary immune deficiency, it means they have a genetic alteration to one or more components that we just went through that makes them vulnerable to? Infections. Because what's the two main responses of the immune response? Dead cell. That's right. That's what you have to imprint on your neurons for the rest of your life. Okay? You have to have two processes your immune system is what for? Get rid of microorganisms, infections, or potential infections, and get rid of dead cells or tissue. Okay? But now, what if we have a defect? And there are a number of these diseases. So I'm just picking some prototypic examples to illustrate what would happen if that immune system is defective, that's genetically changed. What would you expect to see in the patient? So we can categorize them by the humoral response or B cells. They can't make antibodies now. That's a problem, isn't it? Then we have those that have a problem primarily with the T cells. Then we have combos. Both T and B cells are defective. So I'm going to give some examples to illustrate this. What would you anticipate the patient, when they would present clinically, and how would they present? That's what you're trying. And then you could have problems. What two phagocytic cells could have problems that are genetically altered? Neutrophils and? Macrophages. Yeah, they can't eat. We got a problem. So this becomes an issue. Complement. Our important molecules we talked about is to recruit inflammatory cells like neutrophils and macrophages. They're important for opsonization, to sweeten the microorganism by sugarcoating it with C3b, which is a component. When you hear the C3, 1, 2, 5, whatever, that just means complement. And what cell in the body makes complement? Hepatocytes, your liver. Your liver, remember we talked about, is an immunologic organ on the right side. So if you have patients who have genetic damage to their liver are immunocompromised. Or when you can be acquired immune deficiency, what's that? What's the most common cause of cirrhosis in the United States? Is alcoholism. So when you have patients who have cirrhosis, you are immunocompromised because you can't make important molecules that are critical to the immune system. So that's why it's important to understand how different organs, your bone marrow, your liver, they're all making, the bone marrow makes the macrophages and the neutrophils from the bone marrow cells. So we have to know the various components of the immune system to understand why the patient is presenting to us in a very clinically important way, okay? So let's talk about both of them, T and B cells. Now we have to think about physically, these patients are going to be, now T and B cells, what type of microorganisms? I don't want specific names of organisms, but groups or categories would these type of individuals start getting? Bacterial, that's one group. What's another group? Viral, what else? Fungi. Parasites, depending upon where you live and where you're drinking water, swimming in it, whatever it may be. You're exposed to contaminated food. So now, these patients are going to show up obviously very early. We have to remember that the fetus is exposed to maternal antibodies because the only antibody that crosses the placenta is IgG. And so her passive immunity lasts in the fetus for about 6 months. So they're going to start showing up with bacterial infections at roughly 6 months. In terms of if they're getting breast milk, if the mother is feeding the child, you do give antibodies in the breast milk to babies. That's why breastfeeding is good. That's one of the many things that's critical to breastfeeding. You can't get antibodies enriched formula, right? So it's important. So now, what would you see is another important giveaway is where do you have, in physical exam, in any of these primary immune deficiencies, what won't be formed is their lymph nodes. You would not palpate any lymphadenopathy. Even if they got an infection, their tonsils, their cervical lymph nodes, inguinal lymph nodes, you would not find any. Even if they had an infection, because those components of T and B cells are also found in the lymph nodes. And they're defective, or both of them, you won't be able to palpate. So that's it's an important clinical clue on physical exam. They have no lymphoid tissue, and since they don't, because it's genetically determined, then they're going to be a problem with infection. So this one is called severe combined immunodeficiency, or SID, and affects both T and B cells. There's two major ways in which you can accomplish this. The most common X-linked, so what sex is going to be affected here? Males. Because how many X chromosomes does a male have? One. One stubby Y. Okay? So if this is defective, in this case, what happens is, remember we talked about these cytokines, IL-1, tumor necrosis factor, IL-8, and all these other ones? Is because if these receptors are critical to B and T cell maturation, and the receptor is defective, then those cytokines that bind to the cells that stimulate their ability to differentiate, making various types of antibodies, or T cells, T4, T8, then they're defective, they can't mature, and therefore they're prone to infections. Another one is also recessive is an enzyme deficiency called adenosine deaminase. Adenine, remember, is an important nucleotide that's important for DNA synthesis. What's an important place that the body's making has a lot of stem cells is your bone marrow. Because remember, you have a very naive immune system because now you're going to be exposed to antigens as you're exposed to the outside world out of the mother. And so therefore, what's going to happen is that this enzyme is defective where adenosine accumulates in both the T and B cells and the stem cells, and they die. And if you don't have the stem cells, what happens to your immune system? They can't differentiate into the humoral response, the B cells making antibodies, or the T cells that help modulate this. And so now we got a problem. So now we're going to be exposed. So there's different. So how do these patients going to present? Well, what type of organisms? Well, you just pointed it out. It's going to have all these type of, they have a real problem with many infections. Obviously, you're chronically ill. You're not going to, as a child or infant or baby, mature. You get chronic fungal infections. There's spores all over the place. When it's a cloudy day like today, the spore count of Aspergillus goes up. And you inhale right now about 150 spores in your lungs just right now during the day. You don't feel it. But who takes care of it? Your macrophages in your alveolar sacs. But if you are damaged, if you're crippled immunologically, now you can get aspergillosis, a lung infection. Now it becomes a problem. So we don't realize that we're inhaling these microorganisms all the time. If you look good, you feel good, you should be proud of your immune system. Because if it's crippled, we got problems. We take a lot for granted. What our body is exposed to on a daily basis and how our immune system takes care of it. So when it's been altered, it will reveal itself. What type of things you don't want to give these patients is live attenuated vaccine like oral polio, for example, vaccine. Now they'll get the disease because their immune system able to modulate this particular strain is a problem. So the immune system is very important. And then you get other infections like pneumocystis carinii. When you're severely immunocompromised, you think of AIDS patients, acquired immune deficiency, somebody on immunosuppressive drugs for various conditions, as well as if you're born defectively. So how do you treat these patients today? Anybody know? Anybody took the immunology class, they would have talked about maybe about this. How do you think you'd treat it today? We're in the 21st century. Even beyond that. How would you cure them? Stem cells that are reconstructed. And that's exactly what they do is do gene therapy. They'll take stem cells, immunologic stem cells, and destroy the bone marrow and then repopulate them with new stem cells that have the corrected genetic alteration. Pretty cool, isn't it? And so that's how we're dealing with primary immune deficiency. In the past, you would give them a bone marrow transplant and then reconstitute it, but all you do is inject stem cells and they know exactly where to go. You don't have to tell them where to go. They know where to go in the bone marrow, repopulate it, and go out and repopulate the immunologic lymphoid cells. Then you give them passive immunity, gamma globulin is basic antibody, as well as giving antibiotics. Or antiviral medications to help them get through. But today, gene therapy. And UCSF does a lot of this, by the way, as many other places. We have DeGeorge's syndrome. Now we're going to go to the thymus. Where's the thymus located? Right here in the superior mediastinum. We're all born with a thymus for T cells. That's where your T cells. T cells are going to circulate from the thymus and populate your lymph nodes in the pericortical area, where the B cells are going to go to your germinal centers and make constitute your lymph nodes. And your white pulp of the spleen has B cells and T cells around the splenic arteries throughout your spleen. And lymphoid tissue in your organs like the GI tract and respiratory tract. So if this patient is born without a thymus, congenital absence, the thymus arises in the third and fourth pharyngeal pouches that also give rise to the development of your parathyroid glands. And your parathyroid glands are important for making parathyroid that's important to reabsorb bone. So now what happens is you don't have parathyroids as well, plus you don't have T cells. And so what type of group of infections are primarily more common in patients who have T cell deficiencies like this? Is fungal and viral. Remember, how do we fight off viruses? T cells. So they're going to come in with a history of viral infections as well as fungal infections. Their lymph nodes will be smaller. And if they get a TB skin test and they have TB, there'll be no reaction because T cells are important for making granulomas. We went over that. T4 helper cells. Because they're going to affect the T4 helper cells and cytotoxic T8 cells. So the tetany is what is called hypocalcemia, is the clinical term for hypocalcemia, and it's due to the lack of parathyroid hormone to release calcium from the bone. Remember, 99% of your calcium stored where in the body? Bone, 99%. Remember, calcium is only about 1% ionized. It's very toxic to cells if you have too much calcium. So it's tightly controlled, okay? And early onset in terms of months after birth. So this is called the Georges syndrome. Another one is X-linked infantile agammaglobulinemia, and this is A means what? Without immunoglobulin. So what cells are affected, T or B cells, just by that name? B cells, because what makes B cells become what are called plasma cells that are plasma cells make antibodies. So you can't make antibodies. So what type of infections do we use antibodies for? We use it, for example, bacterial infections or increase. And because the IgG is the only antibody, IgM is too big to cross the placenta from the mother, another antibody. So IgG crosses the placenta to the fetus while the fetus is in utero, obviously. And they start getting infections after 6 months. What are the common infections do babies get overall? What organ systems? You were a baby once. I'm sure your parents told you what type of infections you had. Ear infections, classic, because you get a viral pharyngitis. It affects your eustachian tubes. You can't get secretions, block it up. Bacterial infections, get ear infections. What's another organ system? Throat, upper right, pharyngitis. What's another organ system? Skin. You get staph and strep infections are increased. So these are typical of the pediatric group. They're going to be increased frequency as a consequence because you can't make antibodies. Normal cellular immunity because T cells are intact, and it's males because it's on this gene is on the X chromosome. Okay. So when we look at this in total before we go to break, primary immune deficiency diseases, there is the adenosine deaminase affecting the lymphoid stem cells. So you can't make what on the right side? B cells. It can't make all these different antibodies. You're prone to bacterial and fungal infections. And then you can see the X-linked SID that affects both of these, the gamma chains. But there's the Georges. And Georges fix, you're born without a thymus. So what type of infections? Viral and fungal infections as a consequence. And so this is the way you can roadmap and see how the immune system develops. And if you have a genetic defect that affects that development, you're going to be prone clinically. But all the lymphoid tissue in any of these primary deficiencies are decreased as a consequence of the inability to populate these lymphoid tissues with these immunologic cells. B cells have become plasma cells to make antibodies. Or you can't make your T4 helper cells and T8 cytotoxic T8 cells. Any questions? I think it's time for a neuronal break.
This podcast was recorded by Dr. Henry Sanchez at the University of California, San Francisco.